Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thanks for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, and Nick Osello is sober and upset for a variety of reasons. Nick, why are you screaming silently into the camera?
A, because on the countdown before we record, I usually get what I need to get off my chest so that it's not distributed to the audience. So now I just have some pent-up swear words. Second, I'm drinking a Nojito from Spindrift. The not giving up, or the giving up alcohol for Lent has gone great, lasted 7 days.
Congratulations.
Whoopsie. And I was late recording, you know, jumping on this because my dog, Molly, who's otherwise a sweetheart, decided to, about 5 minutes before we hit record, just roll in straight diarrhea. She is a lab husky mix. Lovely shade.
Lot of hair.
You know, gold, lot of hair, thick hair. And about from her shoulder to her hip was a beautiful dark brown of somebody's dog that they must have given, you know, something that disagreed. Grapes and, chocolate covered grapes is what that dog ate, and then just sprayed it. And Molly said, what a time to go do that. So had to hose her down before even letting her into the house, gave her a bath, thought about just, I'm just going to throw away the towels that we dried her off with and everything. Yeah. Like, she's clean now. But man, if she didn't stack up a lot of great, great days before today, I would have just gone, that's it. You're a wild dog, and I wish you the best of luck. So we're rolling. It's a good day.
Meanwhile, you're dressed like a Somali pirate, so definitely fitting to have finished the work that you just did. Larkin, you're also rocking a Spindrift. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. I mean, a lot of interesting narratives in the game that I'm excited to talk about. The world itself is not cooperating, so stressful weekend. Hopefully, you know, get some positive developments in the Middle East. But great to talk ball, and nice to see you, boys.
Why? What's happening over there?
No comment. Let's focus on lacrosse.
All right, before we jump into the college lacrosse, I just want to give a shout out to the PLL for what was another really, really fun PLL championship series. I will tell you that there are people who commute from Baltimore to DC every day, and I do not know how they do it because I've done it 5 times in the last 10 days, and I think I'm going to sleep all of Monday because that traffic is no joke. But with that being said, I think 5 of the first 9 games on the men's side were one goal games, and Friday night was Redwoods over Atlas. It was a comeback. It was overtime. It was an elimination game for the Atlas. And the Redwoods had already clinched the bye to the championship. But one of the things listeners of this podcast know my affinity for my high school alma mater. And the coach of the Redwoods, Anthony Kelly, is an alum, as are Mike Bame and Connor Camille, 2 of the 10 players on the team. And so, you know, I was watching Mike pretty closely. He's the only lefty on the team, so he played like every offensive run. And what does this say for the discipline that you can step in the crease to get a goal waved off, miss 2 sitters, like right on the doorstep, and hit a goalie in the chest for a 4th, and then basically also commit a turnover on what otherwise should have been an absolute, like, goal situation. So basically, effectively cost your team 5 goals, and yet score six goals, throw 4 assists, and make the absolute game-winning play that led to the game-winning goal that you yourself scored. It just is an insane, like, if you cost yourself cost your team five goals in a field lacrosse game, like, that's it. Like, you're just going to the locker room and never coming back. It's just normal par for the course in sixes, and goldfish mentality goes so long in that discipline. My God.
I got to say, too, it only reinforces, you know, having I say I've been passively interested and kind of a little bit more locked in as it was heading towards a championship. Like, it's only reinforcing my point. Sixes needs to be the standard for youth lacrosse. Like, if you're a 4th grader or younger playing, sixes is going to be so much better for development, so much better for touches. And Terry, that point
so
that you just touched on, so much more fun. And hey, you just cost your team 5 goals. Good. There will be ample opportunities to make up for that. I think it teaches all the right lessons. Great for the international community. And I think it's a great product when the best players in the world are playing it. So I had a lot of fun again, this Sixes tournament, and I'm objectively excited for what that's going to do for the sport in the next couple of years heading into the Olympics and beyond.
The one clip that caught my eye, which I think we at least have to comment on, to be fair to the women's side of the aisle, is obviously the coach mental blackout tackling the player in the field of play. I don't think
you've been a part of a game like that.
I was about 12 yards from Chris Bates in the infamous elbow that cost him his job. And I think that if Anthony Kelly like dropped his shoulder into someone carrying the rock, it would be like a national story. So we feel obligated, I think, is probably the word. So it'll be interesting to see how they handle that. And I don't know if I've ever seen that, you know, at that level.
Let me test my interpretation of events based on what you saw, because what I think is the most likely explanation is like effectively lost just kind of her mind for a second, thought that the whistle blown and basically was trying to like separate the players, and then they lost their balance and fell over on top of her. Now, I will fully concede that's generous reading, and there's another look at the replay where it's kind of like the look on her face suggests that maybe it was a little bit more aggressive. Where do you come down on it?
I think my honest interpretation of the film is the latter, which is she had like a momentary lapse and then realized obviously the mistake, and you can see her body language attempt to kind of not follow through to the ground, right? I think one of the most important things you can do as a coach, if you have some piss and vinegar, is like keep it to the coaches. Like John Tortorella famously trying to like climb into the other bench to fight you know, whoever was the coach that night in Vancouver, and then tried to like enter the locker room. But it's very, very different the second that barrier gets broken between like players, especially players on the field. Like it's right. The ball was right there. That's even, you know, that's a whole nother level, you could argue, of transgression versus at least Batesy. It was sub game. Ball was 80 yards away.
Right.
What I will say, though, it seemed to me like prior to that, and I only watched the clip. I'm not going to be able to name any of the players, but ball carrier got smoked in the head. And my interpretation of it was like, hey, this is going to be a fight, and it's kind of the coach's job. And even when I was at Air Force, we had a preseason game against Hofstra. One of our players smoked their goalie, and I was like, oh boy, here comes a fight. Like, it's kind of my job as a coach, whether it was a Hofstra player or an Air Force player. Like, I was there to try and, you know, grab whoever and bring him back to our bench. If it was Air Force or Hofstra, just saying, hey, like, we're good. I kind of interpreted it as she assumed that the whistle was going to happen and that the players were going to get together and kind of start a pushing and shoving match. And she was just there to say like, hey, whoever's in front of me is just, that's the person that I'm trying to create separation between the opponent. And the loss of balance, I'm not sure that was not a flop, we'll call it. And the no intent to go to the ground. I'm kind of taking the coach's side where I'm like, hey, we just need to separate the players. All of a sudden, this world-class athlete falls down. You know, no offense to the bench press strength of that coach. I don't think that she had, you know, that much power going into it. So I'm taking the coach's side and saying, hey, you were just going in to break it up. Somebody lost their balance. And the context being the ball was right there and it looked like the coach, and now it looks like the Friday Night Lights clip where the coach tackles the running back going down the sideline. I'm like, nah, I didn't see it that way, and I stand with the coach.
All right, boys, let's do what we came here to do. So this is my favorite day of the year. One of my favorite things to do, Nick can relate, is take my dog to the park. And I tend to eat dinner around 6:30, 7 o'clock, want to do it after dinner. And for 4 months out of the year, the sun is down. And then for 8 months, it's not. And today is the first day of that 8 month stretch. So I should be in a great mood. But coming off of what was an absolute A-plus slate last weekend, we had what I would characterize as, let's call it an A-minus. It was a good slate for sure. There's no question about it. It almost is impossible to argue that it was great. But that being said, when it comes to like what were the important takeaways to discuss, the games themselves feel secondary to some of the really important trends. So we're going to start in a place that I did not anticipate starting when this week got underway. This weekend got underway. We're going to start in Charlottesville, Virginia. Nick, can you set the table? Are you in that spot?
Mm-hmm. And to your point, as we were kind of crafting how this episode is going to go, even the games that had good takeaways as individual games, I would argue were boring. And maybe that's just because we're coming off of a great slate. So it is going to be more of a storyline related episode. And as you mentioned, to have the most positive day of the year, start with the red flags that are being raised and lit on fire and ran, you know, as you know, fly them as high as you can. UVA is quite frankly in big, big trouble. The takeaway from this weekend being their loss 13-9 to Towson. But as we take a look at their schedule, I mean, they're 3-3. Their wins over Colgate, Stony Brook, and High Point. Sure, you know, good job. Their losses 18-12 to Richmond, 14-13 to Hopkins. And then this head scratcher of a 13-9 loss to Towson, not taking anything away from Towson. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, UVA is solidifying themselves, not just in the last couple of years, but particularly this season as a second tier, you know, B. And Terry's pouring a drink right in my face and just making it more negative than he has to be. God, but I mean, I'm having a bad weekend. UVA's having the worst weekend of all time. And as we look towards the rest of their schedule, guys, it is not getting any easier. Maryland, Utah, Dartmouth, and then Notre Dame, Duke, Syracuse, North Carolina. Real chance that they only win two more games the rest of the season. And you couldn't even convince me that any of their games are wins. Things need to change. What needs to change, Larkin?
I think an additional layer before we get to the kind of 30,000-foot question of what can they do to change, right, is I think heading into the year, a lot of people thought this Towson team was actually pretty good. It's important to characterize that they've had an injury bug issue. I think that their film has been, you know, B-minus heading into that weekend. So remember, they go to St. Joe's and lose in a game many people expected them to win after the departure of Taylor Ray and an untested St. Joe's group, in my opinion, up front. They get beat up by Loyola, is that correct? So this Towson team, I think when you consider the trajectory of the film for Lars's offensive group from Colgate through Stony Brook and obviously flashing in that second quarter against Hop, you know, I think the UVA faithful obviously were hoping the ceiling was a lot higher, but I think many people thought the floor had risen and that this team was at least like trending the right direction. A big piece of that is that obviously because it's Johns Hopkins, like there's a lot of respect in that logo matchup. It feels like a massive game. I think what we appropriately called out last week, and perhaps Syracuse just showed in going to Homewood and winning comfortably, is it actually that Hopkins is just, you know, good in that there are a lot of holes in the boat in Charlottesville. And Towson, frankly, potentially exposed them. Going to Charlottesville is not an easy thing to do. Like, Klockner is one of the temples, you know, the Taj Mahal is in our sport. I don't think they've won there since 1991. Is that right?
I don't think they've beaten them at all, regardless of location.
At all, since 1991. So, listen, I think many people probably think that we beat up on Lars and this UVA group too consistently. But the reason we ask the question, which is the same exact thing we'd be doing to Gary or to Pete or to whoever, is that when you take this job, like, this comes with the territory. Like, this is the University of Virginia. Their expectation is Memorial Day. And to his credit, when he departed, you know, I was in the room when he left, when he departed in June of 16, you know, his first, I believe, six seasons in Charlottesville, really elite track record, frankly, of like tournament production. Like, they went deep, they won twice. Shelley obviously was, you know, if not the face of the sport, one of the best players in the world. And over the last 24 months, I think it's not just the wins and losses. I think it's the feeling of dread that since the departure of Sean to head to Hanover to coach Dartmouth, I think they've lost a little bit of their run and gun identity. And the big question is, okay, we're still recruiting at a high level. Like, do we see an inflection point occurring where it's like, okay, you know, we have the Millens and we have athletes heading in, and maybe like Hopper and Hublitz are going to round into form. But listen, the truth of the matter is most weekends they lose the goalie battle, right? They don't have a dominant athlete at the dot. So, you know, against a Notre Dame or against a Maryland, they're probably going to get beat up at the stripe. And listen, this is something I've talked about ad nauseum, frankly, but their defensive identity, you know, feels like it's missing, and they need to make a decision on, you know, the types of athletes they want to recruit, A, which we talked about at length last week. But B, in terms of like for the rest of this season, they got to figure out a way to junk it up or to change and find a way to manufacture stops. So, you know, this is not easy for me to say. This is a guy who played a huge role in my life, but like he's fighting it right now, and he's got to grind. And there's pressure where he's now coaching, and he's going to feel it, and he's going to fight like hell. And I disagree on labeling a win-loss total for the rest of the year. They're still pretty talented, and I think that they can knock someone off. But I'll pause there.
Do people think we go too hard at them in this situation? Because I looked at Reddit, and there was a thread about whether or not Lars Tiffany's job should be in question. And I looked at College Cross on Twitter and the Inside Lacrosse Slack channel, and that is the conversation, right? This is not – we're going to get to this next in terms of – talking head idiots who didn't play and don't know what they're talking about, which there's only one of the three people on this conversation qualify as, and it's me. I think that, so, I mean, you obviously know Lars better than I do, but I know him really, really well. And the version of him that I know craves this type of attention, right? The pressure that comes with it. I mean, every college lacrosse coach wants to be a football coach, but he is like chief among them in terms of the type of perception that, you know, he wants the sport to have. And I look at So obviously the context here is last year, disappointing, got to bounce back, right? Every program, regardless of its stature, can have a bad year. You just have to bounce back. And the early returns in a 3-1 start were good, not great. To your point, Nick, like those wins are games that you should win. And while it sucks to lose to an in-state rival that is a kind of burgeoning power, you know, it's a team that made it to the quarterfinals last year. There's no shame in going to Richmond and coming home with a bad defeat. The second half against Hopkins, just it can't happen, and it has to be met with a level of fervency that. So one of the storylines for this weekend is games that were over before they started, right? Like I don't want to use the expression "didn't get off the bus" because we used that last week with Syracuse at Princeton, but I mean, it was like 8-0 or 9-0 Penn State over Cornell. It was 4-0 Princeton over Rutgers before Rutgers got the ball in their offensive end of the field. And there were a couple of other examples of games like that. This was not one. Virginia led 2-1 10 minutes in. 10 minutes is like, we've got our feet under ourselves. We know what this game is. Like, each team's had the ball a handful of times. It's kind of, you know, it's whatever. Towson reels off 7 straight goals. That's the game. The game is effectively over. Virginia gets it. I've got the replay going right. I'm watching it. Virginia gets it to 11-9 with a minute to go in the third quarter. There's still 16 minutes left. Like at that point, you're like, all right, well, this is if things are good and your talent is what we think it is, this should end up being a 16-13 Virginia win, right? And it just wasn't that. They didn't score the rest of the way, and Towson was able to separate. So to the point that you made about like 3-alarm fire, red flags, alarm bells going off, like for me, that's what I'm seeing. And it's not personal, and it's not to say that it can't be fixed. But to the point that you made, I also think that these are important conversations to have. I am not a fire him type of person. Anybody that knows me, has read what I've written, has listened to what I've spoken about, would, I assume, kind of know that or agree with that. What I am is contract status matters a lot. And I can't say definitively that this is the case, but I have a very strong understanding that Lars Tiffany is in the last year of his deal. And I don't believe he signed an extension last offseason. which means that Virginia is going to be forced to evaluate whether or not they want to move forward with him one way or the other. And So, I said this in the context of Dave Petromalo's tenure at Hopkins. It wasn't necessarily that he got fired. It was that the administration did not want to give him additional years, right? Like, if he had had one more year on his deal, like going into 21, he probably would have gotten, they would have let him play out 21, right? See the end of his contract. It's exactly the situation that we're seeing with Joe Brescia in North Carolina as well. So I guess my point is that, like, it's the footing upon which you go into a negotiation about your contract status that we're looking at with this situation in Charlottesville. That's the layer that, in my opinion, sits either on top of or below the whole dynamic.
Well, and we can sit here and talk contract law. Boy, that's a fun topic, Terry. Larkin, I'm very curious to hear your thoughts. And I think this is a good way to tee up something that you can give better insight to than I can. And I'll contrast it with my experience with Corrigan. And in a lot of ways, when we had to come down, like when our backs were against the wall, say it was Notre Dame versus Towson in 15, right? We knew that we could rely on the 2-man or on the 10-man ride, sorry. And a lot of what Corrigan instilled in us over the course of preseason, starting in fall ball, extending through preseason, was manufactured situations in practice to where by the time we were playing games, we were very comfortable with a 2-goal deficit, knowing that we had those capabilities, and especially knowing that he wanted us to utilize our exact skill sets. There's a reason Perkovic was always the goal scorer that came back, because he was a physical freak, and all of us knew that we were almost supporting his shot every time we needed to come back. I look at Virginia's offense. I see the Millens, Colsey, Sunderland, like good players. And I remember watching your tenure in Brown, knowing that you guys were a run and gun, let the players make plays. And then I look at Virginia trying to come back from a 2-goal deficit against a team that they have the talent to manufacture goals against. And I'm curious how you think, you know, Lars's coaching approach, specifically on the offensive side, why can't Virginia, you know, let their star power shine in moments like that?
I mean, it's a fairly.
And you were part of this. You were part of the offensive threats, you know, under that system. Who's the pole that's going to be running and gunning?
I think one of the challenges with I'll answer the personnel question to UVAZO, and then I do want to comment on the contract reality and input variables that Terry set the stage with, because I think it's an important moment in our sport if it does head that direction. In terms of their offensive personnel, I think the big issue that Virginia faces is when you have one or two cover pole athletes that can neutralize McCabe and whoever else you want to guard. So let's say you want to guard 9 and 7, okay? If you don't need help to help to either of those matchups, you can effectively like face lock and non-hedge off Sunderland, so you take away his inside help. And then like if you have one other good pole or short stick D mid and you're willing to slide to Colsey, like who else is going to really beat you, right? So put differently, if you don't need to go and go consistently to Virginia, and so you can effectively play like one side of the field in just a 3v3 like push-pull and focus on the 4th, 5th, 6th matchups, I think what we've seen is that whether it be Hackett or whether it be one of the young middies, like they just don't have enough currently to feel comfortable flying to, say, the Dome or to Arlotta or to one of these big boy defensive, you know, places with athletes and feeling good in that run and gun format. So put differently, they almost need to slow the game down, Nick. Like, I think what Lars is struggling with is when you're not getting saves, you really, the math does not math to like increase the pace, right? If he's a high fill help guy, okay? If you turned on the Alabama football film and you saw their cornerbacks like weren't executing press leverage, everyone would have a heart attack, because that's what Nick Saban does. He's a safety, like, right? He's a defensive backs coach. Lars is a high fill coach. Like, he loves living and breathing like defensive help. So I'm sure it's just eating him alive. And then quickly on the Terry point, I do want to defend like one of my mentors here. The only reason the UVA fan base and the national chatter has gotten to the level it did is that he was able to win in year 3, to win again in year 5, and he set a standard that he did not need to rebuild. Like, they were good quickly. And it's since fallen off a cliff. And what I mean by that is He put together 5 years of results that Joe Bresci has never done at UNC. That Gary is yet to reach that level at Syracuse. That Pete Millman is yet to reach that level at Hop. You could argue those are three of the biggest logos in the sport, right next to the UVA Hoos, right? But Lars was, he was good quickly, and a big part of that is Connor Schellenberger. And you have to give credit to Shelly, right? The same way we give credit to the Dylan Malloys. Like, and when it looks so different now than it did even 2 years ago, right? When the variance between the product itself and the eye test is at a level where Terry's telling me the game is over in Charlottesville in the third quarter because Towson goes on a run, of course everyone's going to raise their hand and say, what the hell is going on? But I do want to just say this, and this is important for people who really care about this game. If we get to a place where Lars, with the results he had, you know, if they decide to go a different direction, or even if it, you know, continues to metastasize the rest of the way here and the debate picks up, I really do think it would be a turning point in our game where, like, the notion of job security and the nature of how some of these coaches are judged, like, will have fundamentally shifted. And you could argue that's actually a positive. That means they're making more money and, you know, these are the best roles in the sport. And, like, the optics because of, you know, maybe the PLL's momentum or because of all the work that Terry and the guys do or just the game is growing, hopefully, in participation, whatever it is. You know, like, is Kevin Connery safe? Is Pete safe? Is what's the level that Gary needs to perform at this spring, right? So if we're actually going to fire a guy who's won two natties in the last 7 years based on what Joe is doing, like, just down the road, it is interesting, right? It's like, okay, so what does that mean for all these people who are evaluating whether it makes sense to take that next job versus he could have had a lifetime contract, right, where he was previously. So it'll be interesting.
Let me be clear. I'm not advocating for it. And I'm also, I wouldn't advocate for it because I don't think that there's anybody that can walk in there and do a meaningfully better job. All I'm saying is that the reality of the situation is such that it could create some thorniness this summer. Because again, like, passive, it's easy to do nothing. It's harder to do something. And when your coach is out of contract, that effectively means you have to do something. All right,
and
let's move
what
on.
What a segue. What a segue. And the segue being, I know, you know, you play a little bit in the pros and you kind of get to know the alumni and who are the true disciples of their coach. And, you know, a lot of locker room talk is kind of exchanging stories about how brutal your conditioning sessions were when the coaches were, you know, as pissed off at you as they possibly could be. And I would say the disciples of Lars are adamant defenders of him. And we have one on the podcast here, Larkin. I remember you telling me about how he's impacted your life. I would say the second coach that kind of has that is, you know, and probably the shining beacon of it is Tillman at Maryland. And, you know, this is another, I don't want to poo-poo on them ending their three-game skid, because they did beat Delaware. That being said, a lot of my takeaways from this was this isn't quite the bounce back game that I think Maryland needed to have heading into an interesting matchup against UVA. So, you know, the number that stood out to me was the turnovers, you know, Maryland committing 19 turnovers and still being able to win 13-8. You can say that that's, you know, a silver lining on, you know, going 1-for-4 in their last four. Good job in cage and good job at the X. So, you know, I'll open it up to you, Terry, first, but Maryland writes the ship. I do want to acknowledge that, but did they write it in a way that they can build momentum on?
In my assessment, yeah, because this is another game where a team jumped out on top of the other and the Terps build a 4-0 lead. I can imagine a scenario in which they lifted their foot off the gas because they thought they were safe and nothing would bother John Tillman more than that. And that's why the reaction is more so to his attitude or his demeanor post game, where, you know, Kevin Brown was there covering the game for us. And, you know, I've been around John after losses and there are instances in which he's like totally you know, matter of fact and calm and whatever. Sounds like he was a little bit more ornery after this one. And, you know, I'm not going to try to diagnose why, other than the fact that they're 2-3. But I think that when you're coming off of a win and you're 2-3, and it feels like, to your point, you're riding the ship, and now you have a get right game or an opportunity against Virginia, right? Like, you know, if you see the pieces come together, like typically the default posture is to try to, you know, put wind in the sails and make sure that everybody feels really good about things. Obviously, Eric Spano's health and his unavailability on Friday night is a factor, but absent that, they still made a bunch of other personnel changes. A lot of Spencer Ford, a lot of Matty Higgins early, Chris Lyons on the second line, the second midfield line, and he's productive. Brayden Urksa, to me, looks much more like the facilitator that he is when he's at his best. I do think that we see that with respect to the quality of the opposing defense, way, you know, more substantial, right? Like, you know, and that's a matchup-based situation. It's going to be a theme that we talk about as this podcast goes on. So I think, to me, Maryland is in a little bit of survive, advance, build momentum mode. But I think for Tills and the staff, it's way more, we know what we're working on Monday through Friday, and we want to see it on Saturday, or in this case, Friday night. And my guess is, based on his reaction, he didn't see it. And so, you know, that's where I go forward with that. Larkin, your thoughts?
Agreed. I don't want to nitpick beating Ben DeLuca 13-8. So, Nick, I get why you're asking the question. Clearly a down year for the Hens. I think, to me, they took an important step. I think on a national debate level, what we all need to remember here is that the summation of Michigan's film this weekend, Rutgers' film this weekend, Hopkins' film this weekend, this is a down Big Ten. And Maryland does not have as many opportunities to grab, you know, RPI needle-moving wins as probably the rest of the world thinks. So their season is shrinking. And what I mean by that is, John is, I'm sure, looking at this as, we just got to get better and get to a place where we can beat Penn State in the Big Ten tournament, because we do not want to leave it up to Donna or whoever the commissioner is this year, to put us into this bracket. So I think they took a step. I think the big questions around their primary Dodgers, especially late clock, remain. So I don't think that's been solved. But when you consider how yin and yang the Penn State results have been, like, is it the Penn State team that's beating the wheels off Cornell, or is it the Penn State team that's struggling with Villanova that shows up at Bird Stadium or whoever hosts, right? So you know, Maryland's Maryland. If it's a stock, I'm slamming buy on that thing. I remain a believer in Tillman late in the May.
So I referenced this early in the podcast. I just want to make it explicit. So at the end of the article, Kevin wrote, when asked if any outside noise could have led to his players gripping their sticks a little tighter, Tillman reiterated his belief in his group's ability to continue turning things around. For our guys, we tell them don't read that stuff, but they're kids, so I'm sure they do, Tillman said. Again, I'm like, people who've never played or coached college lacrosse, I probably would not put a lot into those people. Like, they haven't sat in your seat, and they're not in the locker room, and they're not with us every day. These poor kids grew up in an age where they're judged a lot on social media. At the end of the day, it's about focusing on what'll help us get to where we want to go and believe in each other. I believe our guys, and I'll keep believing in them. There was a line, and I must have read it somewhere else, where he talked about, I don't ask my mechanic for medical advice. And first of all, that's a great line. And second of all, like, listen, I say this all the time. Like, what I/we do is create content for lacrosse fans to consume, right? I don't pontificate being a expert when it comes to college lacrosse. That's why I don't coach it. I do think that I am at least good enough to do this job, which is creating content for college lacrosse fans to follow the sport. And so I guess what I'm saying is, like, we're all, like, we all know what we're doing here, right? Like, and to the extent that, like, you know, it's worth it to pay attention or not, that's every individual's choice, and then put stock in it that they want to. I understand that young kids are young, and that getting them rolling in the same direction is a difficult challenge. And that's why it's easier when you can eliminate outside distractions. But I do think that, you know, it's a reflection of some of the tension that's being felt.
Yeah. And it was interesting to me that he called out, you know, these poor kids are criticized on social media. playing total speculation ball. You know, I'm curious what happened, and, you know, Larkin, maybe you can touch on it. I think, 11 to 15 was, I could argue, some of the earlier days, kind of as Twitter was really forming, as social media was becoming a daily part of kids' lives. You know, I grew up and social media wasn't a thing. You know, it started being a thing with MySpace in seventh grade and AOL Instant Messenger. But I do distinctly remember kind of the first, after we lost to Duke, you know, some random anonymous Twitter account DMing me saying that I lost the game and telling me to kill myself. And I was like, ooh, like that was an interesting, interesting day. And I'm like, from Tillman's comment for him to, call out social media specifically, I'm curious as to how early these kids are criticized, how, stupid the burners are. And as a college lacrosse coach, there's probably been some huge shift in dynamics on how to address that for the team. It was just something that kind of caught my eye as, a troll that attaches my name to things, I guess. Like, what are the kids dealing with heading into a game from some burner account who looked up their parents' names on the Maryland website?
Yeah, these kids are just glued to their phone. It's not a, we are not dramatizing that at all. That's just the reality. It becomes way harder to shrink the game and just focus on, next opponent. But Maryland's 21 in RPI, Virginia's 34. That's almost unfathomable, right? So, like, that win this week is not what many people would believe if they beat them. And they don't have that many opportunities left to get statement wins. Really just Penn State. So they just got to focus on the next step.
Speaking of
statement wins. Oh, you're going RPI. Go for it.
Well, it's just that, like, is Army still number four?
I think they're up there. I'll check right now.
Yeah, and they just lost a big game. Nick, your baton.
And speaking of statement wins, look out for Lafayette. Coach Myers gets his third win in a row and their first ever program win over Army. They're a young squad, and this is their second Patriot League, I would say, shocker. That's how it was described in the Inside Lacrosse article, which you should go read as well. And honestly, this was a game that I would say had the highest level of excitement. There were other close games, but the plays that were being made, some of the saves that were being made, and kind of the back and forth, Lafayette clinging to a victory, Army crawls back, and then Lafayette, their face-off guy, comes out and scores on a fast break to preserve the lead to make it 10-8. And one of my favorite names, and I think he should be in the Twarton conversation, Benjamin DiBattista. I mean, his fifth hat trick of the season. And, for Army, it's certainly not a game that I think they were expecting to lose, final score being 9-10. Army's first loss of the season. And for Lafayette, I mean, Larkin, I'll defer to you. Does this say more about Lafayette or does this say more about Army, kind of as we look at the body of work?
I think it says an immense amount about the difficulty in running the table in the Patriot League. There's something unique about that structure of its teams that traditionally play very gimmicky styles. There's a ton of 10-man. There's a lot of interesting zone combos that people throw. Specific to this result this year, I think the nation perhaps overreacted to Army's wins over Yale, over Michigan, right? And what have we learned about Army? I think they're good. I think they're tough. I think they have a very good chance to, and still do, to be a potential Vegas favorite heading into the Patriot League tournament. But at no point did I think that they were a unanimous top five RPI team that was just going to waltz through their schedule. They lost a ton of talent last year. Like, they graduated a ton of senior leadership on both sides of the ball, rope unit, close defensemen. So I think they just need to circle the wagons. I think that I think Myers has been doing a good job of building up Lafayette. I called that out last year. He inherited a program that really, really had been a doormat in that league, and he's now gotten it to a place where they're an extremely tough out. But I think what's fun, and I think that this game is a vehicle with which to just double down on this fact, the Patriot League's wide open. Like, I don't think that really any team in the Patriot League is dead upon arrival. And I think that, you know, I think BU perhaps has at times shown a high ceiling this year. But the truth is, if you just, you know, put Army, Navy, Loyola, BU, you know, neutral site, I think there would be really interesting odds on who people would pick to come out of that. And I think that there's going to be some really interesting matchups down the stretch. So it obviously is a gut punch to Army. It will dramatically impact their math and their tournament math. But listen, you know, this is kind of what Tillman was talking about with social media. If any school and any coach can get the boys to shrink it down and, like, stay inside the room and just find a way to focus on that next result, it's all Breachy and Army. So I'm not betting against them. And I think that they remain in a solid spot trending towards meaningful games in April.
So a few things on this. I think if you were to say Army was going to be 6-1, given Larkin's point about all that they lost, you'd be like, oh, what a great start to the season. I think people are reacting to the loss more strongly because of just that crazy number, had never lost to them in program history. And then also just to Larkin's point, kind of the reputation of Lafayette. But what's interesting is, you know, so this was a team that went 0-11 in 2021. And it felt like they were building over the course of the next 3 or 4 years. And then they had a really strong senior class 2 years ago, and they finished 6-7. So good, but not great, right? Like, nothing that you're necessarily writing home about, but had a couple of notable wins that got people excited. But it looked like they were going to take a big step back in 25 because they had graduated that meaningful senior class with Charlie Cunniff and a couple guys like that. And then Riley Sutherland comes out, and they have an awesome season. And here we are, you know, sans Riley Sullivan, building around. I was talking to a Patriot League coach earlier today, and he was just like, their sophomore class is special. Like, this is a program-changing group. And they're 5-2. Larkin, you made the point that this is a loss that is potentially going to hurt them metrics-wise. RPI doesn't care about who the brand of the school. All they care about is what your record is. And right now, Lafayette is 5-2. And they've got Holy Cross, who themselves are coming off of a nice win over Colgate. And then, you know, Navy, Bucknell, Colgate, Loyola, BU, Lehigh. It's reasonable that this Lafayette team is going to be, you know, at the end of the season, that's seven games? Yeah, they've got 7 games to go. You know, if they go 4-3, that means they're 9-5. That is not a bad loss for Army. So I think the point is that you know, it's the, all right, we kind of knew that we were going to have to take a punch because we had graduated such a strong senior class last year. And this was not the one that we needed to expect, or we expected it was going to be. But maybe that's a good thing, right? Because, you know, thief in the night, you never know when it's going to happen. You always got to be on your toes. And so if it's a go forward lesson learned, then, you know, I would contend that Army now knows that they have to play every game. They can't take anybody lightly. And if they do, they're going to get got.
I think one of the weirdest things about Lafayette is, you know, they're 5-2, and one of those two losses is Air Force's only win.
Yeah.
Granted, Air Force has had a relatively tough schedule with, I think, Duke, Denver, and Ohio State on there. But at the same time,
they also
time,
have losses, you know, to Siena and Marist.
Yeah. And so what I try to find reasons to get excited about, you know, seasons and how storylines play out. And Lafayette's worst loss, Air Force, clearly, versus their best win, Army, it kind of is like, ooh, this could be kind of a wide open, you know, after the top five starts to solidify a little bit, wide open, as Terry flashes the cover of the Inside Lacrosse magazine that says wide open.
I'm not trying to pat myself on the back. It's just that, like, everything seems to point back to this theme, right? Like, it's unavoidable. And one of the things that, you know, I think wide open is this was meant to reference the title contending race. But I think one of the, you know, when I look at the scores every week, and, you know, we've gotten really fixated on Hampton because, you know, they're very close to their first Division I win. And, you know, they were within a goal of Mercyhurst yesterday. They played Detroit Mercy tough. They played, I believe they played Wagner tough, but either way, point is that the delta between, call it number 55 and number 75, is as narrow as it's ever been, right? You know, one of the things that we've heard over the last 10 or 15 years is that, say that, you know, 90s, you couldn't take a top 10 team could not take a top 20 team for granted. But if they were playing a team outside of the top 20, they were, you know, going to win more, you know, very comfortably. And then in the 2000s, 2010s, that number started to creep up, right? Top 30, top 35. Now, you know, it's pretty clearly a top 45, right? You quoted Virginia's RPI. The ability to count on a win for a top team, you have to get really, really far down the rank. But the thing that's changed the most, and I think this is a distinctly 2026 phenomenon, I do not think this was the case last year, is that 75, 76, 77, their ability to give, you know, 55, potentially even 50, a real game consistently is just a for the first time in lacrosse history type situation. So something for the sickos to really celebrate.
And going back to Tillman's quote, I think he said, you know, winning in lacrosse is never easy. And there were a couple of years when I was in college and out of college and, you know, starting to get more into the media game when this podcast started. And I'm like, there are a couple easy wins. Like, let's not kid ourselves that there's, you know, some bye weeks on the schedule. But this year, I'm like, oh, there might actually be credibility to it. And it just elevates the floor of the sport and gives, I think, everybody a reason to be excited to tune in more often.
Yeah, I think about it in the context of like the families of the players for those teams that go to, you know, call it bottom 20 institutions. And, you know, effectively in years past, like if you were playing each other, like you could be excited about it. But if you were playing a team that was like, you know, better than that, it's kind of like, I don't know if we're really going to have a shot to be competitive today. And I don't think that's the case anymore. And I think that that really, really changes the vibe within those locker rooms and, you know, within the families who, you know, strap up, drive 300 miles to watch a game in the cold on Saturday. The downstream effects of that, I think, are really numerous and super exciting. It's really, it also, one of the things about it is, you know, the common conversation is like, should I go to Siena or should I go to Florida Southern? Right, where like, you know, I'm in the top half of Division II. I'm going to win more games than I lose, and I'm playing in, you know, 70 degree weather every single day. It's like, all right, well, you know, if the quality of the lacrosse experience increases because, you know, my team is taking it more seriously and we're winning more games and everything that goes along with that, it changes the dynamic of that calculus a little bit. But we had a handful of top 5-10 matchups that we haven't talked about yet. So let's quickly get into the meat of that.
Yeah, perfect. On Friday night, I watched the College of Idaho Coyotes play Montana State. College of Idaho came away with a great win, and it was very fun. Oh, you were talking about other games. Okay, Notre Dame, Ohio State. Notre Dame comes away with the victory. It's tough to describe this game as anything but kind of a boring game. Like, I'm sorry. I would argue it was a game kind of marked by individual efforts. I don't think there were any fantastic goals. It was, you know, back and forth. Notre Dame had a 2-goal lead. Ohio State comes back. Notre Dame ends up winning it. You know, quality. I think if you were to go through the Madden rating of everything that makes a lacrosse game exciting, it was 75s across the board. But ultimately, Notre Dame wins, and I think the big takeaway was they played a very similar style of game. Notre Dame just had a little bit better caliber of athlete and lacrosse player to where those individual moments, they were able to capitalize one more time than Ohio State. Curious if there were any other takeaways.
This was a Big Ten game, and Larkin's the one wearing a Nebraska hat, so I'll let him go first.
Yeah, it was effectively like flying to Kinnick Stadium to watch Penn State play Iowa in football. I think we did a fairly good job, actually, I believe 2 weeks ago, outlining that with the departure of the younger Kavanaugh twins, I believe this Notre Dame roster has returned to what I would describe as the pre-Chris era, or sorry, pre-Pat, really, back when Kevin Corrigan is extremely comfortable playing 9-8 ball games. He has taken many a team deep into May, like definitionally comfortable after the third quarter, it being like 5-5. Like, he has lived it, he's breathed it, it does not scare him. Now, the flip side of that argument is, I think a lot of people think this is maybe the Vegas favorite right now. And what it does do is if you can get a hot goalie and a hot clamper, it makes them gettable. Like, they're not going to run away from you the way they did during that back-to-back championship window. So I think what I learned is, listen, I thought Rich Ardelli showed me something. He outplayed, arguably, Caleb Fioc and Nett and deserves credit for that.
But, huge but game.
To, huge game, and you know, in Columbus, hard place to go to, obviously. But you know, let's just fast forward. Like if you're now scouting a quarterfinal matchup between Notre Dame and another big program, strong athletes, can we not sharpie in now that it's going to be fairly tight late into the third, fourth quarter? Like that they are going to be playing rock fight games that are going to come down to, a well-timed timeout where you save a possession, you draw up a razor, whatever it is, like old school lacrosse, pre-shot clock era lacrosse would be a good way to describe it. And that Kevin's innately comfortable doing that. So I think Notre Dame's in a great position, but I also think the nation learned that this team is gettable, and I expect them to be beat at some point.
My takeaways were at the offensive end for both teams, which is not the presumed reaction for a 9-8 game. So for Notre Dame, Luke Miller is just, oh my God. Like, there was one where he dodged from X off the catch and scored, like finished going topside. It was like, I didn't know he had that in his bag. And he's a wing shooter and he's a lefty and, he can handle well, but if you can add that dodge off the catch element to your game, we talked about it last week in the context of just how athletic all these Jalen Seymours and Will Angricks and Matt Jeffries of the world are, and how it takes pressure off the attack from the standpoint of their ability to need to be athletes in order to take advantage of mismatches or matchups or win matchups and score. Just, I guess what I would say is, to build on your Kavanaugh point, Larkin, it was an open question as to whether or not, like, had Notre Dame reached a new level recruiting wise, or was it just a Kavanaugh-Taylor thing, at least at that end of the field? And I guess what I would say is, like, it appears, and I say this realizing that they're playing a very unique grad transfer as their ex-attackman, but what I would say to offset that is, the future looks good in Teddy Lally's hands, right? Like, so while, yes, they are going to rely on Josh Ago this season, I don't think that's not a condemnation for their future recruiting, because I think they've got the next guy there. But just Luke Miller is just, oh God, like he's a hard player to dislike, which is to say he's really easy to like. And then, at the other end of the field, what's interesting is, I went to Ohio State Georgetown because, and I said this last week, I felt like there were two teams over the last 2 years that I just really struggled to put my arms around. I would put Richmond in this camp as well. And the strongest takeaway that I came away from that game with is, like, Garrett Haas is a bona fide number one, right? Athletic profile, what he was able to do being guarded by Ty Banks, the way in which he had a sense for the moment on the stretch, impressive. So, I just watched a replay of all the goals and you look at the box score and what stands out is Nick Meyer's teams, basically in my estimation over the course of his tenure, he's had two types of teams, a team that had a bona fide star, a Logan Shuss, Jesse King, Gonzaga, redhead, 6'3". What?
Trey LeClaire is another one.
Yes, that's not who I was going for because he played with those guys. I was talking about more recently, Jack Myers.
Gannon Matthews, Idaho kid.
Well, right, yeah. I mean, Gannon Matthews is actually a good example of the point that I was going to, which is that when they don't have the singular star around which, and this is true even when they do, that it's a like 15 to make however many non-stars there are, right? There's the top nine offensively, and Nick always has more than is the required amount and gives those guys opportunities and will play the hot hand. And so what stands out to me against Notre Dame is Jackson Walsh, two goals, right? Jackson Walsh was not somebody that I came away from the Georgetown game, like, really noting his contributions. And so I only say that to say, you can be disappointed in Ohio State's result. I do not think you can be disappointed in the performance with respect to what it portends going forward. If you thought Ohio State was the fifth, sixth, seventh best team in the country heading into this game, I think there were some people that thought they were better. This game bolsters that. And you might be like, oh yeah, they lost to one by the team that's number one. Of course it bolsters it. What I'm saying is that, like, what I saw in terms of how Ohio State's identity meshes with their good teams, it's back in 2026, which to me was an open question until now.
And going back to the Kavanaugh point, I remember my freshman year trying to figure out where are the X factors that are going to get us over the hump for the Dukes, for, you know, et cetera. And I think Matt Kavanaugh ingrained in starting in 2012 that our attack just rides as hard as you possibly can. That extended through both Kavanaughs, and that became kind of their MO. Was, yes, they're fantastic players, but if you think that they're going to work hard on offense, wait until there's a turnover and they're going to ride as hard as they possibly can. It's been one of my favorite things to watch since the departure of Chris, that DNA has stayed within the attack unit at Notre Dame. And that to me was one of the things that I was picking up during this Ohio State game. Larkin, I think Notre Dame is in for a lot of rock fights. And as far as what X factors go, you can get hot or you can get cold in goal, at the stripe, offense, defense. But I think that Notre Dame is going to be able to consistently force teams that are good at clearing to look not good at clearing. And some of those, oh, we just worked a little bit harder and we got three or four extra possessions. That's the X factor that I see that could get Notre Dame comfortable in those rock fights. Moving on, Richmond survives a pretty close game against Georgetown. The game was tied at 1, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. So it was truly a back and forth affair until the fourth quarter. So the final score was 14-10, and it was all but tied right up until that point. So I think Richmond finally figured out, give the ball to O'Neal behind the net and just watch what happens after that. His decision making, his ability to create separation from his defensemen, and his ability to feed under pressure, to me, just allowed that fourth quarter, particularly the second half of the fourth quarter for Richmond, to just make their offense look unstoppable. Georgetown had no answer for O'Neal. And, you know, it honestly looked like how teams start. You know, that's been a storyline this weekend. Oh, teams jump off to a good start. This was an exclamation point in the second half of the fourth quarter for Richmond. Terrence, do you agree?
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, I want to cheat a little bit here and kind of go away from the rundown, because the main takeaway that I had for this game also applies to Penn State and Princeton, and is kind of like a broad comment on the way that I see offense being played right now. So permission from both of you to deviate. We're an hour in, so and not only that, but this will also potentially speed up the way in which we talk about the rest of the games.
So I'll allow it this time.
Thank you, appreciate it. It's funny that you start with, like, give the ball to O'Neal and let him see what he does. Like, no doubt he's the quarterback and everything that goes along with that. But what I noticed was basically dunks on the crease. And like I said, this also applies to Princeton and also applies to Penn State. So, you know, Penn State, it was interesting in the context of Hunter Aquino's absence, Liam Matthews starting at attack, really good crease finisher, good play around, knows how to play in the high slot, good shooter, accurate shooter from the wing. What the three, and then with respect to Princeton, this to me was very much a Palumbo for Bonanno switch benefit, right? Now you basically have two guys who are incredible around the crease, one righty, one lefty in Burns and Palumbo on the field at all times. And so it gives those guys an opportunity to work together in a double crease situation. It gives the opportunity for both mirrors, right? Whether you attack righty or lefty from up top or down below. And with respect to Richmond, you know, it just felt like, and I'm going to look up his name right now because all I can refer to him as is number 11, but it just felt like number 11, Daniel Picard. And what's crazy is that Lucas Littlejohn is supposed to be their crease finisher, but I thought that Picard did a really nice job around the crease as well. And what I'm getting at is, I think that it's, it, we, so in the last six or seven national championships, we've had either Peyton Cormier, Ian Laviano on two of them, and then Jake Taylor on two of them as well. So my contention, it's not as if crease play has like gone away and is a thing of the past. My contention is that those are the exceptions that prove the rule, because I would say that the last time that like being crease oriented offensively was the late 2000s, when you had Zach Greer, you had Garrett Billings, you had Ryan Hoff, you had
Cody Jameson.
Yes, Cody Jameson, and then Stephen Keough. You had the Ryan Hurley at Cornell, and I think as offenses move to be way more wing dodge oriented, which the seeds for me were very much like the Hofstra, Jay Card, Jamie Lincoln teams, and then the Jamie Monroe Denver teams, that came at the expense of crease play. And so you kind of move through the 2010s, and I think those were kind of the dominant offensive styles. And then over the last 6-7 years, the way that I look at it is, I think the two college offenses that have inspired the most imitation were Penn State in 2019, Granham at trying to find backside skips for Mack O'Keefe, and Maryland in 2022, Logan Mesnauskas naked on the backside after you get all of this X invert action. And I guess what I'm saying is that in the same way that I think really close observers of the NFL saw this season a transition from shotgun to under center snap taking, leading to an increase in play action at the expense of a lot of the spread option type stuff that had been really trend dominant over the last 5 years, it's the volume of good teams that I see playing with way more intentionality when it comes to trying to create crease looks, and then the effects that that has on the spacing, particularly for those backside step downs. And I was talking to a guy about it today, and the point that he made is the problem with some of those offenses that emulate the Penn State and Maryland's is it's not the improvement of the top 10 or 15 goalies, because those are about as good as they've always been. It's that the goalies that program 16 to 40 or 45 are so much closer in quality in aggregate to the top 15. So if you have a naked, no screen, 12-yard backside step down in 2017, a goalie might have saved that 38% of the time. Now he's saving it 48% of the time. And that delta means that that is not as good of a shot as it used to be. And what that means is that offenses have to get goalies moving in order to expect to beat them. Sorry, your thoughts.
I really like that take.
Yes! Good, because I'm going to take a lot of shit at the top.
Well, the only piece I haven't studied is more kind of your layout of whether people truly got away from it. But to just set the table from the defensive side, and I know Nick will agree with this, complicated inside action and or a crease player at the top of the scouting report who deserves respect is the hardest thing that a defensive midfield group has to deal with. Every single player, all four guys high and away, have to be hyper aware. Like if you take a photo right when the front side dodge starts of where the crease guy is, what his C-cut action will be, who's filling and why, like, are we playing sides? How's it working? Are we bookends? Like, what's going to occur? So you just have to really increase your comms. And frankly, what it leads to is just the defense continues to collapse. So that's how you get those high and away step downs where Sergio Perkovic has his hands free. So the path to championship weekend, especially for a program that does not recruit the way, you know, a Duke or a UVA does, it without question starts in the inside. Like, you have to be good inside. And that's why so many coaches are now flying to pay respects to Brody at Hill and to whoever in the, you know, the boondoggles of Calgary or, you know, Coquitlam or wherever, to find guys who play inside. Like, it is such an advantage if you have a guy who can really complicate the way in which you play help D. So that makes total sense. And I guess just quickly to kind of give my two sentences on Richmond, I think Richmond's quite good. I do not think their Cornell win is as compelling as maybe many did at the time. I think we're going to start to see, you know, my prediction at the beginning of the season is that CJ Kearse is a generational lefty. Like, Cornell may still be solid, but I don't think they're as elite as right now. If you turn on the film of Princeton's ball movement on offense versus Cornell's, there's a large gap there. And what Richmond needs to be very, very careful of is they, over the next 3 weeks, they start to play their league schedule. So their strength of schedule will decrease. And they just need to be, and I'm sure Chamati's, you know, peppering them with this, so this is nothing new, but they got to just stay within themselves and keep looking at the bigger mission of, like, we got to be playing our best lacrosse in May. And, you know, you're going to play Delaware and Hobart over the next 2 weeks or whatever it is, right? While, you know, the other teams are playing Big Ten ACC schedules. So, yeah, I'll pause.
It's what we've seen with Georgetown over the last 7 years. And that's where what is so interesting is Notre Dame on, I believe, April 4th, which could be a 1-2, depending on how things play out. I couldn't agree with you more, and it's so, so compelling.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
And chiming in, Larkin, you nailed it. And I'm trying to remember the team that simply ran a two-man game at X, and then they ran they had crease, top center, and then two wings, and they just rotated triangles, and that's all they did on offense. And it was the hardest prep, and it was sophomore year. I think I only got like 3 or 4 shifts on defense, and my head was spinning. You know, so – Terry, that's a fascinating dissertation and something that I'm going to be keeping a closer eye on as I watch offenses. And I think that I'm probably going to arrive at your point, and it's what I started noticing when Richmond went on their run, was O'Neal a good facilitator, and there was no correct decision for Georgetown. And I think that that speaks to the IQ, and I think you may be leading me to water, and I'm not, you know, too proud to take a drink. I think that just speaks to the IQ of the inside players for Richmond, because it seemed like wherever Georgetown made the application and the change to, okay, we need to take away near side crease. Well, then they bumped high. Okay, we need to take away backside crease and high. Okay, well, we did that, and then nobody slid to O'Neal, and he was able to get a shot off. I think a good facilitator and good inside movement, it's why I was an absolutely horrific indoor player, because everybody has an elite IQ and can operate in those tight spaces. So
I enjoy the narrative of this crease stuff, so just to compound it, because I think it's important for the listeners. Lacrosse is a copycat sport by nature. When the Monroes and the whoever introduced the high pairs and the nations in the late 2000s, everyone started playing some variation of this east-west low razor. We recruit all attackmen. We put them behind to dodge Ocello because he can't guard and make slide decisions. And what becomes really interesting is if you're unique, right? So say you're super used to having to guard that. If you have to, on a random Tuesday on short week of prep, guard just like a traditional 1-4-1, two inside crease guys, both that are born in Peterborough and are like a menace to deal with, that's really challenging. So what you'll consistently see is people will like mimic what's successful. And then ultimately, if you're like a laggard in that scheme, actually you can be hard to deal with. And that's why so many people now run the 10 man, because there were a few schools that created a ride first identity of like, we turn the ball over on the ride and we play fast. And now everybody does that. There's not a team in the country who doesn't have a 1A or 1B like 10 man plan or 9.5 man. And Terry's absolutely correct in that. And heading into a week, what you're really trying to identify to like isolate the game behind the game is, what is Nick Ocello horrible at? If I'm an offensive coordinator, what the mental math I'm doing is
nothing.
This defensive midfield does not guard this specific scheme well. We're going to put them in the high stack. We're going to put them in the NASCAR pick because they've never played it. So that's why you'll always see guys going low wing and whatever it may be. And that's frankly what makes our sport actually quite fun. It's like it's a true chess game going on.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, some of those ground ball scrambles, they make it so difficult when you got pulls like Larkin who are halfway up breaking out, you know, while you're fending for your life. You know, it always made it tough. But we only got 2 games left. We already touched on PSU, Cornell. Penn State blows out the Ivy League. But Syracuse Hopkins, I'm going to say this sentence, and you decide if it ends in a question mark or a period or an exclamation point. Both these teams are not great. Both these teams are not great? Terry, what's your punctuation mark at the end of that sentence?
It's a period. I mean, so I covered this game. It was cool. You know, it would have been great if the weather were a little bit nicer, but it was a good crowd. Obviously, it's, you know, the way that I kind of consumed it was just like, this is blue blood lacrosse. And the tweet that I sent was, everybody wants the sport to start on March 1st. Not everybody. Traditionalists want the sport to start on March 1st because they're romanticizing their own experience. And this game felt like what it would be if the season started on March 1st, because Hopkins failed five clears, and I think Syracuse went outside either two or three times in the first quarter. And it was like, yeah, this is the sloppiness that you get early in the season. Not when one team has five and the other team has six games underneath their belt. Like, this is just completely illogical. But what was interesting about the game, in my opinion, is so I went in thinking any of the four outcomes, each team wins close, each team wins big, is available, right? And I didn't have a firm take on what was the likeliest of any outcome, right? So what is so surprising coming away from it is that Hopkins competed at the faceoff X. Despite failing five first quarter clears, they then cleared, I think, perfect the rest of the way. So there wasn't a huge possession disparity. Hopkins took 52 shots. They missed the cage 30 times. Syracuse took 33 shots and scored 12 goals. To me, they scored two goals off the faceoff, two goals in transition, and an empty netter. You can make the argument, and it might not even be an argument, it might just be factual, that because Hopkins didn't score any of those types of goals, they actually outscored Syracuse in settled offense 8-7. But the reason that they didn't score more is because this was the best, and I didn't watch the St. Joe's game, but this is the best defensive performance I've seen Syracuse put in a dog's age. And it could be just the nature of the matchups. The reason that Hopkins beat Virginia is because Hunter Chauvet went crazy and scored six goals. To me, that's a reflection of how unbuttoned Virginia is off ball defensively. He was able to get lost in the wash, emerge with the ball in a good shooting position. Syracuse did not let that happen. And I don't know that Jordan Beck maintained the matchup the whole day. And Billy Dwan was a star of the day because he scored twice, and he is scary in transition. And Riley Figueres erased Charlie Eiler. So really, for Hopkins, it was kind of like, all right, Matt Collison, can you score an unassisted goal? And he did it twice early and he did it once late. And otherwise, that was pretty much it. And besides that, the ball movement that has made Hopkins one of the more efficient offenses for the last 5 years just got gummed up. And there was no alternative because they couldn't win individual matchups. And that's why they basically had to settle for a lot of bad shots that went wide. Where, you know, Syracuse, somebody asked me, like, did they play deep in shot clock to try to wear down Hopkins' defense? I was like, I didn't notice that. Like, I didn't think they played fast or slow. I just felt like it was a game that was defined by Syracuse's ability to take advantage of, you know, these non-settled opportunities. Hopkins didn't either create them or didn't take advantage of them. And when they were in settled opportunities, even though they outscored Syracuse and may have been more efficient, they still weren't nearly efficient enough on the basis of their ability to get advantages during versus Syracuse's defense.
I'm trying to think back to the punctuation question from Nick. I think I would just add a semicolon is probably how I would play that.
I like that. That's an Ivy League education right there. And somebody that knows it's March 7th or March 8th.
To condense this into acute bullets, I think the world overreacted to Hopkins beating Virginia. I think Towson just proved that. I think the world clearly overreacted to Cuse beating Maryland in the Dome. I think what we know is that both these programs have sky-high expectation. To me, neither of them are trending at a level where they are clearly playing on a product basis on a 1-4 seed. Hop's not even close, but Cuse, who, you know, as recent as 2 weeks ago, everyone thought Joey Spallina was like walking to the Torreton ceremony and they were going to be hosting a 1 or a 2 matchup in the Dome. So I think it's just back to the drawing board. I want to be careful to overstate the warning signs, because I just told the world I think the Big Ten is pretty down. Do I think Hop can handle Rutgers and Michigan? And yeah, I do actually. But that's not their goal. So like, this is Johns Hopkins. They want to go deep. And the key to me is, outside of Collison, who's a professional athlete, he's going to play indoor and outdoor, and outside of Chauvet, who's a world-class shooter, can absolutely fill it. When you play a Notre Dame, or when you play an Ohio State, or a team with a true defensive identity who can execute a plan, they are going to be able to neutralize the top of the scouting report. They have to get production down the ladder. And I think the reason I framed it that way is I actually think you can make a hyper-competitive argument for Syracuse in the same light. Like, I think, you know, for them to – their path towards reigniting their upside case is using Johnny Mullen. Johnny Mullen's got to be better. Like, I think many Q's faithful thought he had a chance to go, you know, 65% in big games this year, and he's been quick twitch. He's just – he's getting flagged too much for false starts.
Yeah, he violates – I think he violated four times.
Violates a ton, and it just sucks the air out of the barn. And it's the
nature. And against Princeton – where Andrew McMeekin was winning like 35% coming in, he just gifted him three possessions like right out of the gate.
Correct. And untimely. It feels like in a big moment, it's like you're getting quick clamped. The D's grinding. I really like Dwan. They actually got saves, right? McCool played solid. So listen, both these teams are talented enough and have the resources to jam this down my throat. But like, again, I go back to, people were attempting to annoy 22 and saying that they're heading back. And right now, the product, let's say the Princeton offensive product and the way that thing's trending, that's a different elasticity of that slope curve to the way the Syracuse offense is trending. So they got to get back in the lab and grind. I think they're both okay.
I'm intimidated by elasticity of the slope curve. I feel like we breezed by Cornell Penn State a little too fast. I just want to ask Larkin, to what extent are you concerned that, you know, they won whatever it was, 19 straight games, and then they get a pinprick in the balloon by virtue of a one-goal loss to Cornell, and then now all of a sudden the Emperor has no clothes?
To be clear, you're asking because of the loss to Richmond. Is this now – got it.
Is the loss to Richmond the chink in the armor that created – the blotto that Penn State put on him?
No, I think what Penn State displayed is the talent gap between Cornell's roster last season. Just to call out two players, I know there's probably more down the lineup, but Kelleher, big, strong, dominant right-handed athlete, ACC athlete, right? CJ Kearse, top 3 to 5 lefties the last 50 years. They're drawing a ton of attention on the offensive side of the ball, okay? I think what the world now knows is Cornell – is they are well coached. They are younger than people realize. They need Firth and Goldstein to develop into a 1-2 or a 1A, 1B versus both of them were more twos and threes last year, playing off of a true space eater. And their path is through improvement and an Ivy League tournament result. It's not like I feel proud of myself for calling this out preseason. Like, they just weren't a top five team heading into the year. The players they had coming back were players that deserve credit for rising to the moment in massive games last spring and getting that program over the hump. Some of those poles made big plays. The rope unit grinded. Goldstein really stepped up championship weekend. But that is like a very different equation than, hey, this is a full slate. People are going to be preparing all offseason. You know, Jordan Stevens, associate head, one of, you know, from my side of the fence, I played like in the same era. Those are like best friends. They're good buddies, losing him, right? So there's a little bit of turnover on staff for Connor. But Cornell's good. Like, again, this is not – losing a generational talent's hard. It should be hard. It would be weird if it wasn't. So I almost think, to their credit, they go to a Denver, they beat them. Like, this team's rock solid, and I expect them to – you know, find a path to three wins in the Ivy at least and be a maybe a two or a three seed at the Ivy tournament, and then we'll see what they have, right? It's like And that probably feels right. So I don't think it's Emperor's no clothes. I don't think they're swimming naked. I think they have a good plan and they're prepared. But Penn State exposed them. I mean, they got their head kicked in. And we all need to, like, take account of that.
Nick, I apologize. One more for Larkin here. I just got a text. It's from Tristan Erlin, and he would like to know how you're feeling about Brady Wambach right now.
Don't care. Also, don't text Terry ever and bring up my name. This is the last text that I got from him, and I'm sure it's kind of a reverse text. Nick Osello, son of slain Ayatollah, named Iran supreme leader. So thanks for that, TD. Covering both sides of the spectrum right there. But listen, to cap this off on TD, what a bummer that is.
No, give Larkin an opportunity to answer.
I think the blessing and the curse of having the platform I do is if I'm going to play on my toes and chirp people, I need to be able to, like, take a punch. That was as rough a performance as we've put forth in a decade of ball. I think that...
Jumped out to a 3-0 lead.
Yeah, UNC, hit two pipes on dunks in that stretch. We were a little bit off from the start. I think what I would tell them, not that anyone cares what I think, but is I genuinely think this team is better than that product. And I think that our path has always been find a way to, scratch and claw to 3-3 in our league. So it's just you can't let this result, like, suck the hope out of the room. You got to just get back to work and, find a way to right the ship. But there's no question. We got kicked in the head and, got beat.
Do you guys have a preferred getting kicked in the head pop culture reference? Because for me, it's when Crazy Joe DiVola kicked Kramer in the head when he was wearing the helmet and it saved him that he traded Newman for. You guys know what I'm talking about? No? All right.
No.
I think that's a geezer reference.
Yeah. I'm so old.
Was that, was
all the time for listeners, hit my mentions, make me feel better. Nick, you got anything else we want to bring this pot in for a landing?
No, just that nobody asked me what punctuation mark I would use on the question I proposed. The only reason I asked you was so that you could turn it back on me. But I would say
what punctuation mark would you use?
Question mark for Syracuse, period for Hopkins. I think Syracuse's ceiling is higher, and Hopkins... just another year of, given their expectations, mediocrity. Kyle Harrison, fight me about it. And so I'm going to go see how much of the diarrhea made it down the bathtub drain, and if we have to use Drainol and Febreze in the bathroom.
Wait, can I just understand? Your actual question was what punctuation mark would you end the sentence with, and your answer is two of them. You would do well in doing that.
and listen, if I wanted to get pompous and talk about the elasticity of the demand market curve, stock market, S&P 500, you're the guy starting off the podcast about the Middle East. So I don't think you have a ton of room to talk about decorum.
Good pod.
All right. Unbelievable notes and end on. Thank you for listening to the Tailgate Podcast. If you like what you heard, leave a rating and review. Tell a friend. We'll be back next week with more Inside Lacrosse Podcast. Thanks, boys.
Love you, Terry.
Love you, Nick.
Love you, Larkin. Love you, Larkin.